either because they're undertaking party business, which they are entitled to. But that's their prerogative.
In the same manner as the Honourable, late Honourable Oriani Ambrosini learnt, if you're on party business and you've got a bill here, you cancel party business for the bill. So all of us may have had to learn some lessons the hard way, everyone sitting here. But it is unfortunate that we do require, the fact that not all chairs want to insist on a written apology, let them be the person who responds, not me. I insist that when it is a party matter, your chief whip has given you that opportunity to do it. If it's a medical matter, it's a doctor's matter. If it is compassionate leave, it is the chief whip of your party who grants you that. And so it goes on. And I think those things are clear. When it comes to a bill, whether it is a committee bill or a bill that is here, I said at the beginning and that when people make a contribution, and I re-emphasized it here, you put the party name. You don't put subs, ANC. You put ANC. Because that party has canvassed the opinion that their member is going to give us. Because every one of us sitting here, unlike local government, is not an independent. We come from a party. And that is how the national and provincial legislatures are run, including perhaps not necessarily the NCOP. So it is important that your colleagues should brief you on this. But as I've said before, that in some of the parties here, members, colleagues don't brief each other on what is going on. And I think it is important, if you're a member of a political party, then you have every obligation to brief your colleague on what they may have missed, because you're here from one party. And you, no one is here under their own hat. No one. And I must make this clear. But why are we giving the Honourable Macpherson the time to address certain things? Because some of the issues he raised came after the official deadline and were not in the bill already. Others were incorporated already. So I spoke to Mr. Hermans and said the advocate should, those issues that are not covered within the bill in her opinion, and she could be wrong, should be in a box so that that person has the time and opportunity to speak to it. And let me say, Honourable Macpherson, that your time that you spent on this will add value to this bill.
Not if no one's read it.
I would hope that people do read it, Honourable Macpherson, because they have an obligation as members of Parliament to get through their work. It is just regrettable that I don't have the authority to run this committee as a school teacher.
Not horrible.
Right, now, maybe we can move on. But I do, and I think I heard even Mr. Williams, Honourable Williams, agreeing with two or three points. Because you've actually read it.
Yes.
So it does pay to read the bill, not the bill, the inputs of people who've made it. And also as just plain courtesy. All right? Dignity and the rest in our Constitution. Those of you who haven't read the Constitution should actually resign from Parliament. Now, let's get back to the issue in question. No, it's important. A lot of people haven't read the Constitution. And it is highly regrettable when you think of what people fought for. Right. Advocate van der Merwe, please. Now, I said to you in the break that I am sorry that you're on your own here. And the resources in Parliament, anyone here, you know, in every party should appeal to their chief whips to ensure that the legal division is properly resourced. Because it isn't. And some people are working more than overtime to keep up with legislation. But over to you. We had finished on our page 12 with section 9, if you recall, Advocate van der Merwe. And you said that seems like a good place to stop before an application in terms of this section. Am I right? So from there, and if we're going too fast, slow us down. All right? Thank you.
Thank you, Angie. We've actually dealt with subsection 3A. That is the issue of courts where a provision is in a court. So I'll make a few changes there just so that we know what is the difference if there's more than one agreement and so on. The next issue is paragraph B of subsection 3. In my presentation, I've indicated I'm not sure about this. This is the issue where a consumer who is part of the debt review process, whether that should also be excluded in respect of applying for debt relief. So if someone is already subject to debt review, should we say that person is excluded? So I don't know what we should do. It could be, because the one thing that I just mentioned was, what if the person's circumstances changes and he can't afford the debt review anymore? But perhaps then he could be terminated and then he can apply for debt relief. So, but that is something to consider.
Right. Honourable Mason, Honourable
Williams. Thank you very much. Chair, I think the one thing that we need to recognise in this process is the established means of dealing with people that have debt problems. And that there are established means for people who have debt problems. Now, someone who is in debt review has met a very strict set of criteria to enable them to enter in debt review. They have an income. That income has been assessed. Their liabilities have been assessed. And a calculation and assistance and services has been provided by a registered debt counselling service, and an agreement has also been reached with creditors. So clearly that person is able to meet their restructured obligations. Now what we don't want to do is we don't want to undermine that process. And I don't think that we want to take people out of that process because it will create instability in the debt review mechanism, which I understand from statistics works exceptionally well from people that enter into the debt review process to the time that they exit. I'm not saying that there are not problems with the debt review process. I mean, we all know that there are, and that is something that needs to be looked at. But in my mind, someone who is in debt review should not then be able to terminate that process in the hope that they would then be able to access debt relief. So I would strongly support or advocate for a position that someone who is in debt review should not then be able to access debt relief. However, obviously circumstances change, but I don't think it should be a quick option for people to do so. And I don't want to jump ahead because I know we're going to get into the application process. But I think that one of the things that we need to look at in how the process unfolds is, I think the first option in that application process, whoever looks at that application process, should be to assist people through debt review. That should be their first option. The first option should not be debt relief, because we want to rehabilitate, we want to educate, we want to assist people to remain in the system and be good credit consumers.
You see, I think that point is valuable that you've just contributed, and I think what would help us, Honourable Macpherson? You know, you have got the document, which did take time to prepare. As you go through that, and you make reference to something, it helps us almost use it as one of the hearings that have come in, that in the paper, this is paragraph 2, to contextualize there as you talk. And you heard me saying earlier to Mr. Hermans, I want everything numbered and in files, because some of us are going to refer to other inputs that are here. But thank you very much. Was it yourself, Honourable Williams?
Thank you, Chair. With regard to this, I think that the object of the bill before us is to address the gap, you know, the people that can't go to a debt review and are falling underneath that. So I don't think we can include them at all. While somebody is in a debt review process, they are excluded from debt relief measures. You know, if they, you know, that's what we should just say. They can't be included because that's the purpose of the bill, is to deal with the people under who can't access debt review. So they automatically fall out.
Can I ask the members something then? Are we actually saying, and please comment, that our intention was to address only those who are not in the debt review plus the others? You know, who could never have got there anyway, as it were. And that anyone under debt review, I'm not saying you're saying this, I'm just trying to express how I'm understanding it. They were there, they owed this, but actually they're not getting anywhere fast at all. But they're excluded because they are under review, and the debt that has been addressed is 15,000. I'm just putting that to you. No, because, you know, in the end, when people say they don't want your law, they'll take it to the Constitutional Court, which will say, is this fair? You know, what are we looking at here? So I want to be very clear. I don't want abuse of the system. I don't. But what are we actually saying? Let us apply our minds. Honourable Macpherson?
Thanks, Chair. I think it goes back to the point about, you know, as you quite rightly put, you know, who are we speaking to? And I mean, one of the greatest pieces of legislation that's been written in this country post 1994 is actually the NCA. I think it's an incredibly powerful piece of legislation, and I have deep sympathy for the CEO of the NCR, because I know she's doing an incredible job with very limited ability to actually enforce the NCA as it should be. But the NCA makes provisions to assist and protect people who are in a debt trap through debt review.
Yeah.
So, but what the NCA doesn't do is it doesn't go further enough to, which is what we're trying to do, to assist people that can't make that threshold for debt review. So I'm not sure that people who make that threshold for debt review should be included in this bill. It shouldn't be speaking to them because they're catered for in the NCA currently.
All right, that's a view on the matter. Do we agree? Nothing, right, okay. Let's move on then.
Thank you. The next thing is the actual application. We're done now with who and what and when, and when not. So Subsection 4 then deals with what the application must be supported by.
Is that the evaluation?
Yes, so It is still busy with Section 88A.
Yeah.
It is now Subsection 4 of that section that we're dealing with. The application contemplated in Subsection 2 must be supported by. The things that I have looked at is proof of income and expenses. And later on, I provide that the minister can prescribe what would constitute proof. I took this from also from the municipalities and their policies on indigent and what must be...
Sorry, Richard, I think for us is that 14.
No, 12.
Because I thought it was 12.
It is 12, you were correct.
Yeah. Oh, there we are. Yeah, it's just that my numbers haven't come out. I think something's covering them. Okay, box. Okay, go ahead.
Thank you. So, the proof of income and expenses, what the municipalities allow are things like UIF statements, bank statements, things like that. Then also information about the total amount due by that consumer, any credit agreements that relate to that debt, credit insurance agreements, if any, regarding restructuring, and I included a statement from the consumer regarding the order contemplated, but if we are going to go according to a hierarchy, then that will of course fall away, and any such other information may be prescribed. This may be too much information to ask. We could maybe just simply say income and expenses and the total debt, and it will speak for itself. But this is kind of what I thought might be applicable, and then it can rather just be discussed by the committee and we can take out or add.
Right, Honourable Williams. And yourself.
Thank you, Chair. The section, it talks to credit agreements that are related to the debt contemplated. Surely we need to know all of the credit agreements that they have, because the person could have, like we said before, 500,000 rands worth of debt somewhere, and then be applying for debt relief on another thing that's only 15,000 rand. So surely they must declare all the debt that they've got in order to make sure that they haven't exceeded the 50,000 rand amount of debt in total. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable
McPherson. Thanks, Chair. I'm just wondering, and I'm not for 88B. Have we decided that the NCR is going to be the body or entity that receives these applications and sort of, you know, does this work? Because it would be important to hear from the NCR if they are capacitated and funded to do this, because I suspect that there's going to be a lot of, you know, paper filing, keyboard tapping away, and that's going to require a substantial staffing component to do that. So, I had put it in my submission, you know, whether it needs to be a body outside of the NCR to do so. I think it's. I'm really glad to see that that credit bureaus will be contacted, because I think that that's important to determine the total amount of debt. But it goes to the question that I had asked yesterday, with who bears the cost of providing that information from the credit bureau. I know the Honourable Williams will say we can deal with that later, but and it's something that we can. But I just want us just to keep it in the back of our mind that there is a cost for doing B1 and 2. B1 and 2. So that there will be a cost related to that. Oh, sorry. I keep going ahead of you. I apologize. I'm very sorry. You could just hold my comments in abeyance.
No, okay. No, but we're all on the, you know, same area having challenges. All right, will you move ahead then, please, Advocate?
I'll take the note from Mr. Williams in respect of the credit agreement. Then, on to the next section, 88B, which is now the evaluation of the application. So, once this application has been received, and here I've inserted National Credit Regulator, that was kind of the instruction, not kind of, that was the instruction from the subcommittee and in discussions with the credit regulator, but maybe to add on to what Ms. McPherson now already discussed, that maybe just come in as well. But yes, so what is required from the body that accepts the application is to give proof of receipt to the consumer, because that will be used in any further attempts to get debt recovered, and also to notify credit providers and every registered credit bureau. The block underneath that simply indicates why it is necessary to notify them, so that they can, if necessary, confirm debt and so on, and they need to know that the credit agreement is being considered. So I'll maybe just stop there for now.
Yeah. All right. I think we're coming into your area then, Honourable MacPherson, am I right?
Yeah, no, I don't need to repeat it.
Yeah,
I heard it's Honourable Williams. I don't need to repeat it. But I think just some responses for the NCR would be helpful.
Would you go ahead then, once you're going?
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Just to respond to Honourable MacPherson's question, NCR's once capacitated, we can do the job. Let's just take, bear in mind that there are matters that, for instance, we referred to the tribunal and decided to withdraw and settle them, because of the length that it was taking, for these matters to be dealt with. However, we still, would want also, the NCT to be called in so that they can respond, for themselves. But, given additional capacity, we believe we can do the job.
Right. I think that's the point that we're coming back to quite frequently, and it is something we'll have to keep in mind. Is this going to mean an increase in financial resources or what? We do have to keep that in mind, right? A due proceeding advocate.
Thank you, Chair. In fact, that is a very important point, because in our memorandum on objects, we need to indicate financial implications. So I just want to make a note, NCR needs. But I suppose the thing is, whether we go for a new body or the NCR needing additional capacity, on both of them there will have to be additional funds to be considered. The next subsection is actually just kind of speaks for itself, but this is how how the debt review is worded, and I've taken from that process. So it simply says that the consumer who applies and the credit provider accepted must comply with any reasonable request and must participate in good faith. If I can take you back to subsection 1, there will be something added here. We discussed earlier this morning about the notification actually to set out the income and expenditure declared as well as the debt, so that the credit providers can see the whole picture before they respond. I'm going to go on because I don't think 2 is really, it's very a non-thing. Subsection 3 will now be deleted. That is the issue of the affidavit being filed. So I don't know if I need to stop.
Yeah.
Thanks, Chair. I just want to inquire, and it was in my submission for sort of, the process of looking at the application. Should the bill compel first or legislate and state that the first objective of an application once received by, let's just say, the NCR, for argument's sake, should be to look at the application and say, actually, does this person qualify firstly for debt review?
Sure.
And then put them on to, or is their job purely just to say that they qualify for debt relief, yes, it goes left, or no, declined, carry on. I think that we should look at putting something or wording something that if the person foremostly qualifies for debt review, they should then be pushed into the right lane. If they If they don't, then they get pushed into the left lane for debt relief.
The point I certainly hadn't considered, and it sounded very much like when I die, I could be in the wrong lane. Yes, Honourable Williams.
Chairperson, the purpose of this committee bill is debt relief. To give debt relief to our over-indebted community, populace. I don't think that we should aim at putting people into the applicants immediately into debt review. I'm not saying that it shouldn't be part of the process. It should be if they're rejected, then they should be, I don't know if, you see, my concern is it going to take up too much of the debt relief resources? You're sorting through the stuff, wondering if they qualify for debt review, and then maybe they don't, and then all the resources are now moving to debt review as if they should have been in debt relief. But if it's, because how do you know that they qualify for debt review? You have to do a process to get them to qualify for that. So that's what I'm saying. I'm saying we should be looking at debt relief as number one, and that's the only function of this and savings of this bill.
I want to just refresh our memory. Do you remember when Ms. Gibson was there yesterday? She was saying, she was just sort of participating, engaging in the discussion, obviously not to be taken and said this is now in black and white and concrete. But you know what? You need to have this box issue. So, you tick this, you tick that, you tick the next thing, you put this amount in, etc. And in the end, whoever gets this application then goes, looks at this and says, all right, I mean, all the boxes are ticked. We must process this. Do you remember those words of hers?
Yeah.
Of course, that is assuming that we've chosen the right issues to be with the boxes attached. But now I'm hearing something else, and it may be important for us all just to get the schematic diagram in our heads. So we're saying this bill goes out, it's now a law, and calls on anyone in debt, who's earning, his debt is not above 50,000 and he's not earning more than 10. And I'm simply giving you an example now. Says, oh gosh, I've been waiting for this. Now, he starts. The fact that he could have gone into debt relief, because I understand you can go there for 7,500, am I right, and below. So he could have gone there, in theory, but he sees and says, no, look, you know what, I think I qualify here. He fills in that form, or she does, sends it in. Then I pick it up because I'm the one getting these applications and I say, no, man, 7,500, he's earning 10. Send it back, he can go to debt relief. So I'm just trying to get this in my head here, advocate. Can you spell it out for us schematically? Here, South Africa is a bill, it has an act. Can't be more than 50,000 and you can't earn more than 10. Did you
want to
say something first,
Honourable
Williams?
Yes, Chair. What I wanted to say was the criteria to be under debt review must be different from the criteria to be under debt relief or debt forgiveness or whatever we're going to call it. So that should automatically decide whether or not. So there should be a clear difference. There can't be any blurry lines you perhaps can apply for one or you can go to the other one. It should be clear and precise. And so what we should do is we should find out what are the criteria for debt review, and then those criteria are not the criteria for debt relief.
Now, you see, we've got a point here. Who's going to respond to that from the officials before the advocate comes in? Yes,
thank you, Honourable Chair. For anyone to be under debt review, remember what normally happens is that the consumer will approach a debt counsellor. The debt counsellor then assesses the application. The debt counsellor will look at your income, will look at all your expenses, and in certain instances they will reject that application because they believe you are not over indebted. what perhaps you need to do is rearrange your finances. Go and sell your BMW and buy a small, cancel your club membership with Virgin Active, stuff like that. So only when that whole assessment has taken place and they believe that even after doing all of that, you are still, battling, you'll still battle to pay your debt, then they will approve your application to go under debt review.
Maybe I could just clarify something. When you go to these people, the debt counselor, can you go there free of charge, or the moment you go in? Because to me, often when you just walk in and say hello, that's already cost you something. So is there no fee? So I can sit down, see you, and there's no charge for that?
There is a charge. You see, there is a they charge for the assessment. They charge even when they reject the application because they spend time to do that assessment. The rejection fee is 300 rand. Currently.
No. All right, but if to go in there now, do you have to, like the doctor sometimes won't see you unless the money's on the table?
No, it doesn't work like that. They first of all conduct the assessment, and once the assessment is done, they will decide whether you should pay then the first installment because you now qualify to be under debt review, or if they've rejected the application, you pay a fee of 300 rand.
All right,
let's hear from you. Thank you, Honourable Williams. You see, well, you've clearly, we've never gone there.
No one
can go. Can I? Oh, thanks. So, yeah, exactly. So what I'm saying is we shouldn't waste the time of the whoever does the assessment on whether or not you qualify for debt relief on them looking at whether or not you can qualify for the, debt review. Because it's going to double the time of the process. And remember, the minute this bill's passed, 3 million applications are going to arrive at your front door. So, if we double the time, it's going to be very time-consuming. So I don't think that we should have that. I think you either qualify for debt relief or you don't. Yeah. That's it.
All right. Do you know where we were just in your absence? I just clarify if you've got to come with some money in your hand to ask for help. And it was pointed out, no, you first get assessed. And if you reject it, it's 300 rand. That's the current fee. And otherwise, it's going to be this large amount. But you heard what Honourable Williams was now saying. Yes, go ahead.
Thank you. It seems odd to me that, we all accept that, there's a lot of people with debt problems. And if they don't meet the debt forgiveness, the debt relief program, the NCR wouldn't then push them to debt review. We would just let them carry on. That doesn't make sense to me. And I mean, we know what the primary intention of this bill is, but surely there's a responsibility to say, if you can't meet this, but you qualify for debt review, that's where you should be going. It doesn't make sense. It's just like, we'll carry on then.
At this particular point, Honourable Williams.
Shepherdson, I'm not saying that people will be irresponsible and just send the consumer out the door. What I'm saying is, in order to qualify for debt review, there has to be a process that goes through where they look at your, like you said, your income, your expenditure, etc., etc. During the debt relief system, if you say, I've got a membership of Virgin Active, I think that instantaneously, it removes you from the debt relief program. So I think that we shouldn't. I think perhaps that the NCR can suggest to the consumer that you didn't qualify for debt relief. Perhaps you should look at debt review. But I don't think that they should go through the criteria or say whether or not they qualify or not, because then they'll be doing the job of the debt counsellor.
Right, now, just a minute before we carry on, I want to just alert some members, or all of us, that's pointed out to me as well. On our page 15, it refers to, not that we're there yet, but in fact, there's a reference to this issue, orders related to once-off debt relief 88C. Page 15, 88C, is that what you've got?
Yes.
Then you'll see it says a single member may consider X, etc. The tribunal may, in addition to its other powers, etc., after having considered the referral, contemplating that or any other relevant information, make an order that the consumer does not qualify. So it takes it to the debt relief.
Yes.
So they, and I would understand that if they start abusing their powers, there would be a problem as well. So before I take your comment, the Honourable McPherson, let's allow the advocate, because what she says may take us out of this conundrum.
I really would like an interjection.
I think you've misunderstood what I was trying to say.
Yeah.
I'm not asking a CEO for you to do the job of debt counsellors. That's not your job. But I think when you look at the application, and let's say someone comes with a salary of 10,000 rand, clearly they should be pushed to go and seek debt review.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. I think that should be a requirement for you to do. If they don't meet debt relief, they should then be said, please go and seek debt review. And not just said, well, you know, good luck, enjoy the rest of your Sunday.
Yes. Sorry, I was enjoying the discussion, so I didn't put my hand up maybe sooner. Subsection 4, I want to skip it because it deals with records and unlawful and come back to it, because I want to take you to subsection 5, which says that when the regulator evaluates the application, you must look at all the criteria, and then on the next page, or for me, on the next page, paragraph A.
Subsection 5.
So subsection 5 of 88B, subsection 5, paragraph A, then says, if the consumer does not qualify, the regulator must reject the application. And in that event, sections 140 and 141 apply, so it's like a non-referral. Paragraph B says, if the consumer does not qualify for want of debt relief, but is nevertheless experiencing or likely to experience difficulty satisfying obligations, the regulator may refer the consumer to a debt counsellor for debt review or assistance with a voluntary plan of debt rearrangement. So it is absolutely provided for as one of the things. It's currently May, but we could change that to must. So that is something that can be done. But definitely there is provision made. Paragraph B.
Now, well, we should already change it. Remember, we agreed on principle.
So that can be done. So it's definitely, it does not require them to consider the debt review criteria, but it says that they must push them in that direction. The thing that I think would distinguish debt relief applicants from debt review applicants is exactly one of the first debates that was held of that amount of the income.
Yes, you see.
Because remember, we are with two views, the 7.5 and the 10,000. That those people will actually not really be debt review candidates because they cannot afford the fees.
That's right.
So, and that will cut them out of debt review.
Now, thank you very much, Advocate. Honourable Van Skalkwyk, I know you looked like you wanted to just comment there.
No, I
hope it hadn't been covered by Honourable Williams.
No, can you comment?
Because you're well entitled to make
I'd like to comment. This is informal. It seems that Honourable McPherson didn't read the bill because this piece about the...
We're going to page by page. No, in your
submission.
Look, this is not on record, Honourable McPherson. I think sometimes members like a little lighthouse and half
the
Anyway.
No, luckily this is not an ANC meeting or chairs would have been flying.
Well, and tell me what happened
in those VA meetings where they tried to offend people.
No, it was offend people. We actually hold people accountable.
But you still allow them to function at their jobs.
We just keep the chairs.
Come on. I think all of the parties have got their internal challenges, to be honest. It's like families. autism. There isn't a healthy family without a problem. Right. Now, members, exactly where
are we? If we could go back to the previous, just to the subsection four that I skipped in order to answer the question.
That's right.
Okay. So what happens in subsection four is, and I'll need to make some amendments to add things that we said must be excluded from this application. So what happens here is the first step that the regulator must do when looking at an application is to look at reckless lending, unlawful lending, and the debts that need to be excluded from the application.
Right.
So if it is reckless and unlawful, it must be referred to the tribunal, who will then make an order. So that is what this one is saying. Then going on to five is where I've now started talking. So that can either reject and refer for debt review. If they, and I again repeat, if it is reckless lending or unlawful, refer it for the appropriate declaration. Or if the person qualifies for debt relief, refer it to the tribunal to grant, with a recommendation to grant debt relief. Then the next, sorry, I just want to go back to the bill. Could I have it on the...
Yeah, we can get there. That is helpful.
Section 88C is then what happens in the tribunal. I've headed it orders related because that's mostly what we're looking at here, but I do allow a single member of the tribunal to consider an application. There are, in the section that deals with the tribunal, it does say, I think the chairperson of the tribunal can allocate a matter to a single, but it's an option. I want to here make it much clearer that we are looking at single members, looking at these. In fact, we must maybe also change that to must, instead of a single member may consider, to say a single must be, by a single, in fact, I must maybe do it the other way around so that it is clear it must be a single member. So I'll just make that change.
It changes maybe what we intended. We're saying, look, two people can look at it. However, a single person can, rather than must. Do you follow? If you say a single person must, you're excluding if they want to have two. You see, so I would rather say a single person can.
Okay.
Right, are we agreed there?
Right. And then these orders, and gosh knows what, half a dozen of them.
Then two goes to the powers, and it just says that any other orders that they may make or may do, that they may do, they keep all of those powers. And I've then broken it up so that we have one subsection dealing with possible orders that might not be debt relief, and then a subsection that deals with debt relief orders. So first I'm looking at if they reject the application, or if they feel, no, we don't think this person qualifies, but we think this must be referred for debt review. Then the order could be a request to the regulator to refer the person for debt review. They could declare a credit agreement reckless or unlawful, make specific performance order, or grant one of the debt relief. What will be added here on these orders is something that we've already discussed, the fact of excluding orders in respect of other court orders, and so on. So I'll just make those in there, but it's more consequential almost now. So that is what that subsection deals with. Then the next
just hold off there for a moment. Are you at this stage, is that exactly where you are or further on? Because I thought you were further on. And then you at this part where it says C declare. Yes, oh, that's better, yes. Right. So then we were on C, once declare, where is that?
The bottom of page 14.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, go ahead.
Thank you. So these are the possible orders. In other words, it's may grant, but may reject, may refer, may declare, etc. Then the next subsection,
yeah.
This is where the tribunal must, if they want to now grant debt relief,
yeah.
They need to distinguish between types of debts that might be there. So the credit agreement. I will also add maintenance and child support, because that is something that must be identified as a possible debt, and debt from other court orders. So that will be added. Sorry, I just want to go where I am.
Honourable Williams.
Sorry, I'm just confused. When you say maintenance and child support, what I just want you to put that in context. Is that debt that's going to be relieved or debt that's not included?
That will be debt that cannot be extinguished.
Okay, that's what I want.
The other thing also is developmental credit agreements might come out if the decision is that developmental credit agreements should not qualify for debt relief. It's one of the issues that we've parked. So depending on that decision will just affect here. So now the tribunal has differentiated between certain things. And the reason for this section is that when the orders come, I can refer to specific paragraph to say, in the sake of this paragraph, you can make that order, and so on.
Yes, go ahead, sorry.
Thank you very much. Addicted 3B, can you just identify what other credit agreements, just as an example, what those would be?
Thank you, Chief. Other credit agreements would simply be anything else. In other words, I'm going to... It will look a bit better now that we're going to add a number of other types. So we'll have, if developmental credit stays, developmental credit will be A. B will be debt related to maintenance orders. C, debt related to child support orders. D, debt from court orders. And E, any other credit agreement. So they will fall into the categories that can be extinguished, those any other credit agreements.
Thank you, Chair. The only concern that I would have with the word other credit agreements being included would be, well, you know, vehicle finance could be an other credit, or mortgage could be other credit, and that just gives the ability for the tribunal to determine other credit agreements, and I'm not comfortable with giving them discretion, and I think we need to get away from discretionary powers as far as possible when we're dealing with a very limited scope.
And we're referring to unsecured credit, are we not? I'm just checking.
That is right, and. Point taken, and I think we can amend it and make it more clearer, because the idea is here, is that, remember, the tribunal has now already decided the person qualifies. So the debt before them is qualifying debt. Now, from the qualifying debt, they need to distinguish. So what I perhaps just can do is other qualifying credit agreement.
Yeah.
Yes.
That thing makes it clear we're not opening it up.
Yes.
Yeah. I think that helps. Then, you see this thing, man.
The next subsection is going to change quite significantly now, because as I understand the instruction, is not to provide discretion, but to provide for a progression of orders.
Yes.
So the first one, in fact, the maximum interest, fees, and other charges will probably move back to the previous subsection as one of the possible orders that can be made instead of granting debt relief.
Okay.
So subsection 4 there, paragraph A, 1 and 2 will move over as a possible order to be made other than debt relief.
Uh-huh. So that one there about
a determination, you know, for a once-off debt, the bottom of page 16. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. I'd just like to speak to that point because I did make a submission in that regard. As one of the possible orders that the tribunal would be empowered to give would be a suspension of or at least a cap on interest for 6 months if they believe that consumer could in fact meet the requirements of the credit agreement, with the option then for the NCR to review that process once they had completed that 6 month what you can maybe call a probation period, and if they had met those requirements or the circumstances had changed, to reevaluate that particular position of the consumer. But I think it's important just to note that that's one of the orders that the tribunal could make with, as the advocate would say, sort of an escalation process. And then obviously one of them can also be a full extinguishing of debt if they meet all of those absolute criteria.
Yeah, I have a difficulty just with where we're going there. But, yes, Honourable Laura Tierko, did you not have your hand up?
I was listening to Honourable McPherson. I was saying the point that you say is not satisfaction being the suspension, because it's not more than 12 months. He's saying we must include it as an order or what? Or should we leave it here? Yes, because it's here. We want us to move this to be part of an order of.
Yeah, just a clarity there on it.
Yeah, no, thanks, Chair. It is covered, but I thought that the advocate said that it was going to move to another point, and I was just explaining the background behind it and what my thinking is on how that process would work, on why I had motivated for it not to exceed 6 months,
yeah,
but for it then to be reviewed if the circumstance has changed. I was just explaining that particular point.
Let me allow Honourable Williams before I comment.
Chairperson, I need clarity here. I'm not sure what we're talking about at all. I'm completely lost. What are we saying? We're saying that the first order will be to suspend the interest on that debt for 6 months. Is that what we're implying?
What we're saying, no.
Because I don't know what we're saying.
All
here.
Right,
can somebody talk to me in little words?
That's why I say let's get Advocate van der Merwe, because we're not all on the same page there.
Thank you, Tim. I'll try and I hope I can explain it well. What is currently on the bill? Let's maybe start there. Subparagraph 4, I included capping of interest as a possible debt relief order. The reason for that was because it was discretionary.
Yeah.
It is not something that will apply always to an applicant for debt relief.
Uh-huh.
However, if we are going to go from a strict progression of orders, in other words, every single debt relief application, if the tribunal grants debt relief, the first order will be, I understand it to be, suspension for 12 months. That's the first order. But we still want them to be able to cap the interest.
Mm.
So instead of making that a debt relief order, one of the possible debt relief orders, I'm going to move it across back so that it becomes one of the possible orders to reject, to refer for debt review, to cap interest, or to grant debt relief.
So
we're clear, because it was our discussion which informed the advocate that it's got to change its location. Go ahead, Advocate.
Now, my question around that is then, if we accept Honourable McPherson's proposal that it's 6 months, I'd like to know why, if the person can't afford after 6 months, they can't afford after 6 months. So, you know, this period, surely it's going to be capped And then what happens? What happens if this is implemented? Short. I think it should be 12 months.
Yes.
Understand you correctly, advocate, that the whole thing's going to be 6 months because it's shifting back to this other point.
The capping of the interest is currently 6 months, as Mr. McPherson proposing. The suspension will be 12 months. But I did, when I presented, say that I'm a bit concerned whether 6 months is sufficient for a person to show that they have rehabilitated themselves. Also, a problem with 6 months and then a review is we need to think about capacity, because within 6 months that person has to come back to be reviewed.
Let's hear what you're saying, ANC.
12 months. The ANC is saying 12 months.
But thank you very much, Honourable Tierko. That was loud and clear.
Thank you very much. I think when it comes to this particular point, is that why I had suggested that is that throughout or in that process after 6 months, there needs to be an evaluation of how is the consumer doing. What we're going to do is we're going to wait until that suspension has gone to its maximum term, and then only look to review them. And I think that it's not to say that after 6 months that the interest cap falls away, but after 6 months if their circumstances have changed, then the order changes. But if it hasn't, it would continue. But I think that there needs to be the intervention to reassess how the consumer is doing once the order has been granted.
You see, what I'm understanding here is that in the first instance, particularly on the point you made about when your circumstances change, in any event, we've already stated earlier that the moment your circumstances change, you are obliged to brief or inform X. So that's going to happen anyway. But the next issue has to be, would you do believe, look, after 6 months, this should be reviewed whether or not your circumstances have changed? And I think most of the members sitting here, and keeping in mind that these are not all the parties represented, but that the ANC is actually saying, no, 12 months for two reasons. 12 months, 6 months is too short. But secondly, you'd really be pressurizing the resources of the tribunal to say every six months this has got to happen. So for those two reasons, but if you feel quite strongly about it, we can flag the point for further discussion, Honourable McPherson.
I'd like to do that.
Right, thank you. Okay, are we agreed? We flag and move on.
Okay, then back on subsection 4, paragraph B. So we are now, this is now going to be the first one. So it will be reworded so that the first order is given is suspension, and will probably be of all the agreements in part or in full. No, it will probably be in full for 12 months. Not for a period, not a scene. It will simply be for 12 months. Before the expiry of the 12 months, however, and this is perhaps where the minister will part of the prescribing will indicate when this review must take place. Because, we talked about the timeline. If it is going to take the tribunal 5 months from receiving the application to making the order, then this review needs to start in month 7. If it's going to take 2 months, then it can start in month 10, because it must be before the 12 months. So So this is a bit of a tough one, and the tribunal and the credit regulator need to understand that there will be implications because it will lapse if there is not an extension of the order. It is maybe something that we need to make provision for, but it is also a bit scary because if we say it will automatically extend until the order is made, what do we, you know, what are we saying?
Just so that everyone knows, and I have seen your hand, Honourable McPherson, is you're on this point here that is showing overhead. Is that right?
Yes.
No, I didn't think so. There we are. Right. Honourable McPherson?
Yeah, I just want to ask a question, and it's loosely related to the point. But, and we're just talking about the timeline from when the application, excuse me, from when the application is received to when it's actually adjudicated. What happens to that credit agreement from the time of the NCR believing that it is, that it does qualify for debt relief? What happens to that credit agreement between then and actually the tribunal adjudicating it? Does it continue to incur interest up until the point that it is adjudicated? Because one of the submissions that I've made that the NCR should have the power to suspend credit agreements until such time that they are actually adjudicated and an order is handed down. And I think that that's something that we need to look at, because if someone was to make an application and, you know, they may well having to still pay interest until such time as it is deemed that they do qualify or that it is set down for debt review. So just some thoughts around that.
Anyone else want to comment just on that, Honourable Williams?
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I think that that's a very good point, and it might have slipped through our fingers there at the subcommittee. Yes, something must be done, because it could take months, you know, and that person could by then get taken to court because they haven't had a ruling yet. So I don't know what we should do there. I think perhaps we should give the powers to the people that decide whether or not it is, it does qualify for debt relief. At that point, there should be some powers given. We don't know, you know, we haven't decided it's you yet. It could be somebody else.
Now, I think the point that you raised, Honourable McPherson, that the Honourable Williams is agreeing with the exigency there. How can we do that, advocate?
Can I have to make a proposal before the advocate?
All right.
Yes.
Chair, I think, I do hope that this will slot into the NCA because, it, I mean, that's where it belongs. But what we could do, advocate, is it could be an amendment to the NCR's powers, because they should have the ability to suspend credit agreements, whatever credit agreements they are, until an order is given. Whether they are reckless, whether they are in pursuit of debt relief, I would like maybe just a separate point or an amendment to the NCA, mm-hmm. because quite frankly, I think that the NCR should be able to suspend a credit agreement whether they're reckless or in seeking debt relief.
Just a moment, you know, not having a secretary, I need to just communicate with a member of staff urgently.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, is it not possible to put that clause into this actual bill that it says when... I'm talking about is it not possible to put it into this bill so that it says when a when a customer, when a consumer is given the go-ahead or is recognized for debt relief, then that debt that has been recognized will immediately be suspended. And then we put it into here. Because I'm just thinking about the time that it's going to take to amend a different bill.
This is why I say it's important. The point you're making, Honourable MacPherson, is a very solid point in terms of a substance. But I think let's keep it in this proposed committee bill. That's what we're saying. So before I hand over to the advocate, please speak.
Thank you, Chair. I think, however, that this is where we would come unstuck. In the law of general application, I'm not sure that it would be fair to say to someone who has put forward an application for debt relief can have their credit agreement suspended, but someone who has made an application for reckless credit is also not afforded the same assistance.
Honourable Williams?
Chair, I disagree with Honourable MacPherson, because debt relief measures are very specific to people who are the poorer of our populace. Mm-hmm. So this is a debt relief bill, and in order to facilitate that debt relief, we can't have a situation where somebody, yes, you're going to be under debt relief, don't panic, and then they get taken to court in 3 months' time because it hasn't got onto the top of the pile. So I think we should put it into this bill here.
All right. That is being made, but I do want the advocate just to indicate where we could slot it in, etc. We also need to flag it for further discussion, but if you could just comment, advocate.
Thank you, Chief. We already have something under the effects of the debt relief, so it's 88D and it's subsection 2, which says that the moment the credit provider receives notice of an application, so not even if it is successful, just an application, that notice stops his or her right to go to court. So they can't enforce. So the application stops the right to enforce. What we are not doing is we are not suspending interest from the date of application and charges. It could be risky to do so because the person might be applying just to get out. I think that was something that you've mentioned this morning, Mr. Williams.
Yeah.
What then happens is, what I'm not saying is I'm not saying to the consumer, you are allowed to stop paying. Mm-hmm. But we are saying to the credit provider, you're not allowed to enforce by law.
Okay.
So you're probably able, you can still send your accounts and stuff, but whether the consumer pays or not, is you need to take that risk maybe in relation to this. But once the tribunal makes an order, and this is perhaps where we can change it, is that perhaps the order can be from the date of the application. So in other words, if you are successful, I mean, the fact that interest runs in the meantime, so what? If the tribunal says it shouldn't have run from the date of application, then it's done not from the date of application. Because even if we go to the point of the regulator recommending, what if that takes 2 or 3 months? So if we take it back to the date of application, so that is what I'll do. But then I would simply say I'll have to maybe word a specific subsection in the orders to say that an order capping interest, all of those things can happen from the date of application.
All right. We have indicated, Honourable MacPherson, that you're not fully on board with it yet.
Right.
So obviously it'll take further discussion, but we're moving ahead at the moment on it. All right. Where are we now, advocate?
We at the next one. I just want to quickly make a note of what I've just said.
I think the most important thing, this is all on record, is that it is important that we know the target group that we're trying to address.
But, I mean, people who are given money recklessly are targeted. I mean, they're not wealthy people. They get money recklessly lent to them.
But the thing is, I mean, this is still off the record at the moment, is that the reckless lending is actually covered in the legislation.
Yes, but the credit agreements are not.
Now, we're not saying it's been implemented effectively, but it is there. It is there.
No. It's and not.
The powers
no,
are
not.
The problem.
The
no.
Mr. Figueroa cannot suspend. They cannot. She cannot suspend their credit agreement.
Yes, I think the powers are the issue. It is there. It is there. Let's not say things aren't there.
No.
The problem is around the implementation and the powers.
The power.
That's the issue. So that requires another form of amendment. What we are trying to achieve is a ring fence issue. Go ahead,
Okay, thank you. So the first step, the first order then would be suspension for a period not exceeding 12 months, and then there will have to be a review of that before the expiry of the 12 months. I provided for a further extension of that 12 months if necessary, or a final order. That is perhaps something that needs to be discussed. That was something that is how the MENA programs that I came across work. So there will be a 12 month, if they see that you are getting back on your feet, they could do another 12 months whereafter then. So once that period is now done, then the next order would be now they will do an assessment again after the suspension period, and then we need to then perhaps look at, because if the person's circumstances have improved, but the person probably needs some debt review assistance now. So I will probably have to just make provision here after the suspension that the tribunal can go back to the subsection 2. In other words, refer for debt review or cap interest and maximum amounts of repayments, or if it has worsened, the circumstances have worsened, then we're looking at extinguishing. And what I'm providing for in paragraph C of subsection 4 is extinguishing of a debt, but I am providing that it could be a percentage of the debt due, as long as it applies to all of the credit agreements. So I don't know if that is what the committee then wants, if we are now, because remember this was all because of a discretion that was there. So if the committee says, no, we want all of it extinguished, then that is what I'll do. So it's suspended. Suspension period is done. Now we are reviewing. The person is definitely getting out of debt. We either lift suspension and he just can go on his way, or we refer to debt review, cap interest, or whatever. Or we see circumstances have gotten really bad, then debt is extinguished. But I'm just thinking, would there not be a situation where the tribunal would perhaps say, look, we can see that your circumstances, even after 24 months, is getting better, but not so good that we want to refer you to debt review, or we can see that even if you cap interest, you won't be able to pay. So we will do a 50% extinguishing of your debt, because the other 50, if you cap interest, you can actually repay. I don't know if that is maybe something that the committee want to consider, or do we just say blanket extinguish after that 24 months? In other words, it's been extended for another period of 12 months. Clearly, you're not getting out of this. We just extinguish. That is maybe something that needs to be discussed.
Thank you, Advocate Honourable Williams.
I think that we should just extinguish after 24 months if the people can't pay. Because, you know, if we start giving percentages, we're going to start off with, you know, 10%, and then, you know, it'll be problematic. This is a debt relief legislation. So I think after 24 months, if they can prove that they've got no way of repaying this debt, they should have it extinguished. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now, anyone wants to comment on that point before we move on? Let's move on.
Jay,
just a note, I need to apply my mind to it, so I'm not going to comment to it. Yeah.
You see, and that's where you need to really just catch me then. Flag us, please. Right, on board. No, all right, let's move ahead.
Thank you, Chair. Then paragraph D will probably also change because these conditions would probably be required throughout the process because it might be something that is specific to this consumer before the tribunal. But the limitation on the consumer's right to apply for credit would probably only be applicable from a final order. So in other words, while the debt is suspended, the limitation on the consumer's right to apply for credit will be automatic. That doesn't have to, but once the suspension is lifted, whether it is about repayment or whether it is about extinguishing, then there needs to be an order in this regard. So I don't know if we want to make it up to a certain period, which is then actually provided for in subsection 6, so it ties in with this order here, or if you want to give a flat period for which it is. And then, of course, the one thing that needs to be added is the buyout provision that Mr. Williams talked about. But probably that would be the consequences rather, where a person can rehabilitate himself earlier. So I think at this point in time, D will change significantly. There's two things that are very, very important. The one is the limitation on the consumer's right, if that is a discretion on the period or a set period, and the attendance of financial literacy or budgeting skills, because that is probably an order that should be given with suspension already. Maybe that needs some discussion.
It's very difficult to fix this. Any comments? Now, if people want things flagged, they should say so, or we're going to move on. Right.
Okay, let's move on, Anthony.
Okay.
Sorry, Chair.
Chairperson, if the advocate is saying that we should make a decision on something and there is nobody saying anything, then we should just automatically flag that.
No, the point is this.
We're not making decisions today, Chair.
No, we're not making decisions. I think what she meant really is, there's some agreement here. We're not flagging it, per se, for further discussion. It'll go into the next process, that's what I'm saying. But there's some issues that we're not even near each other here. That's what I'm really saying. But this one, there's no strong objection, put it that way. So let's move on. Right. But yes, when this is not the day for decisions, we know that. Thank you.
Thank you. The next one is subsection 5. That one is also just actually a bit of a technical amendment. It just says that Section 84 of the Act will apply to a suspension. Section 84 deals with suspensions of credit agreements.
Honourable Williams?
I'm lost again. So the section that talks about financial literacy, we're just going to... Did you mention that now? Oh, I'm sorry. I'm completely lost here. So, yeah, that's it. Sorry, Chair. So the financial literacy thing that we were supposed to discuss that we didn't discuss, I missed that. So I'm a bit skeptical about the capacity to make compulsory financial literacy programs for all the people that get debt relief, because that's the implication of that. And the cost of that, who's going to pay for that? And, the 6 million people who are going to apply for debt relief after we've passed this bill, are going to all expect to get, the bill says somebody must give them a financial literacy program.
Well, of course, the ideal is yes, there should be this program. But I think we may flag that because we can talk about that is the decision per se, but there's what is called a progressive realization of these things. In short, the Constitution talks about housing for everyone, but there's a progressive implementation of it. So we're saying this, but we note that it may not be feasible to immediately ensure that 6 million people get it, but that the means and measures to achieve this implementation must begin. That kind of thing. So I think the principle is we want it, but the challenge is how. Do we agree then? All right. I am watching the time, everyone.
open the door. Just close the door.
I'm just getting warmed up.
No, for Pete's sake, we need fresh air. I see half of you went to school with her.
See, if I may just on this education thing, paragraph 5 indicates any matter that in the view of the tribunal will aid the consumer to improve his or her financial position and become a productive member of the society. I stole that from the preamble of the Act. It's one of from the purpose of the Act, the National Credit Act. I was actually of the view that includes any attendance of educational training or something, which means that we can perhaps remove the specific reference to training, but maybe in the regulation section provide that the minister must make regulations regarding education for consumers, especially those who have gone through debt relief.
Oops. Chairperson, I think that proposal is from Advocate Fatima is the right way to go. Yeah, spot on. I second that proposal.
Honourable McPherson.
Chair, that would actually rely on the minister, doing that. I think we can't write a bill that wants to assist people who are seeking debt relief, because, let's be honest, they're mostly poor black South Africans that probably don't have an education that I had received or many other people had received, and so I learned how to budget and, do etc. Surely we want to, in one hand, assist those people who probably through no fault of their own have got themselves into this situation, but also we want to empower them not to get back into that situation.
Yes, I think that's the
problem. And I think that unless we codify it in law, we're going to be relying on someone else to do it. And it's at someone else's, we can say we must, but I would hope that we could flag it and come back to this.
It's a very serious point. And I mean, I don't know if you don't want to do a bit of toying to wake up or something because you're all asleep. I mean, if you're not yawning, you're physically asleep. I mean, let's wake up now, all right? I don't know why it is, but I'm not sleepy.
No,
this just innervates me, energizes me.
I'm getting my application ready.
No, but I think the point cannot be overlooked, and I think in principle we're all agreeing, but how? You see, that's where we come back to it. How do we achieve this? What's the best way? No, please leave that open. I'm asthmatic. I need oxygen. Right. Thank you. Advocate Van der Merwe.
Thank you, Chair. The next subsection 6 is then, I think, part of the parks issue, because that deals with the limitation on a consumer's right to apply for credit and whether differing periods should apply to differing orders or whether a blanket period should apply. So I'm just going to mark that, I suppose, as flagged.
Right.
Then we're moving quite a bit, actually. We then get to 88D, which deals with the consequences. So subsection 1 there deals with the consequences of the actual filing of the application. Not approved yet, just the filing of the application for a consumer. So firstly, the consumer may not incur any further charges under a credit facility or enter into any further credit agreement. The unless and the subparagraphs 1 to 5 deals with the ending of the application, so the circumstances under which the application will be regarded as done, so it is rejected, or all the agreements are declared record or void. or the consumer does not accept a referral for debt review. All these processes have all been terminated. The period for which the person may not apply has lapsed. So that all will be there. Then paragraph B, that just is if the consumer is referred for debt review and the consumer accepts that referral, I wanted to make it clear that it is still voluntary for the consumer to accept debt review, then the consumer must comply with the provisions of the Act about debt review. It speaks for itself, but it's maybe not too bad an idea to put it there. And then lastly, where once of debt relief is granted, must comply with any conditions that comes with that order. Speaks for itself, but these are the consequences. Subsection 2 then deals with the credit provider's consequences on the application. And very similarly, almost mirroring that of the consumer, the credit provider who receives the notice of the application may no longer exercise or enforce by litigation or other judicial process any right or security under that credit agreement until, and then A to D, is the ending of the process.
Yeah.
So that's just that. Three, subsection 3, also deals with the consequence for the credit provider, and what it says is if the debt is extinguished or if the credit agreement was reckless or void, the credit provider may not, in respect of the part of the debt that the order applies to, but that will now be, no, it will probably remain because void could be in relation to just a part of the agreement. may they not enforce that agreement. Okay, well, that is an important one there. I don't want to skip that one. Okay, 4 is quite important, I think. No. 4 just deals with the, subsection 4 deals with the situation, in fact, I am now lost. Oh, there we go. Once it's granted, once the consumer is granted once of debt relief, that's what subsection 4 deals with, the consumer may still not enter into any further charges on a credit facility. It stops. You cannot. 5, subsection 5, is the one that I think is contentious in itself, and depending on what the decision on the developmental credit will in any event change. But even if the decision is to retain developmental credit, this I think needs to be looked at in any event, because what 5 says is this block on the consumer in applying for credit does not apply in respect of developmental credit or public interest credit. And the feeling of people, I don't know if developmental credit should be retained. You will remember I said public interest credit is those things where, that section 11, where there's some public disaster. So yes, but the thing is for the person to be able to apply, even if they're under debt relief. Because the question is, as far as came from you, about this person is now starting to get out of the debt relief. He is rehabilitating very nicely, and suddenly his shack and everything burns down. There is this public interest loan, but he can't apply for it, so he's in a problem. So public interest loan credit should probably remain, but the question is, do we want them to still be able to apply for developmental credit in that period?
Let's check with you, Honourable.
Chairperson, this is very complicated, I think, because what happens is if the individual or the consumer is getting through its debt and has decided to then go to university or get some qualifications and has got a loan for qualifications, so what are we going to stop him from getting that loan because he was... So I think we should include developmental credit. We should leave it in there. And, I think we should.
That's one view that we've got here.
Is there another view on the table, Honourable McPherson?
Chair, I just asked if we can flag that because I just want to do some further research into that issue.
That's fine. Here ahead. We flagged it. Go ahead, Honourable Advocate Van der Merwe.
Thank you. Chair, then subsection 6 deals with things that the consumer must do if it is granted want of debt relief. And I've made a note here because we also had a problem with what if circumstances change between applying and the order. So I've made a note. I need to somewhere make provision for that. But if the consumer was granted the want of debt relief and something has changed for good or for bad, they must notify the regulator of any change in financial circumstances. So I will just somewhere make a change to that so that it is also in the period between application and the order. Then the consumer, I think, must notify within 60 days of the event. So 60 days might be too long, but I was thinking of the type of person that the applicant is. You know, so we might make it shorter.
Looking at the most vulnerable.
And, you know, they're already struggling even to have the bus fare. So I think you've got to err on the side of caution here, right? Let's leave it.
Then C just says the regulator must evaluate those circumstances and make a recommendation to the tribunal who can then amend the debt relief order. I did not want to say rescind because if the debt was extinguished, that can't really be rescinded without some implications for the consumer. Especially now, in fact, if we are going to make provision for a buyout, if the consumer is able to rehabilitate him or herself, then it can be done in terms we'll make provision for that anyway.
Right.
So I did not want to put rescind there because I thought that might be a bit...
Thank you.
I saw yourself, Honourable Williams. Yeah, go ahead.
Is this not appropriate, the place where we put in that clause about buying yourself out? Or buying out of... this should be where it is. So that's what we should do, put it in there. Okay.
And can I just ask, is it a buyout on the capital amount, or is it a buyout on capital plus interest, or capital plus a determined amount of interest by the NCR?
Yeah, I think that needs to be discussed. What do we want? Is it just capital? Is it the amount at the date of application, for instance?
Sorry, Chair. I think when it comes to this buyout, there should be criteria. I think it should be looked at in the way, what can that person afford? Because, you know, you might have got a good job. You know, you might have had a good job before, got into debt, got debt relief. Now you've got another good job again. So maybe you can afford the full amount of the debt. So I think it should be on a case-to-case, because the buyout process, there must be a process for that. So one of the criteria must be, you know, if you want to be taken off the list of people who can't apply for credit, then you must do the following, you know, things must be filled in, what is your income, et cetera, et cetera. So it must be an affordability process. I think that's the way to buy out. If you want to buy out completely and you can afford it, then you should pay back everything.
Right. Honourable McPherson.
I think what Honourable Williams says has merit. But, I mean, I think at the end of the day, it's going to be a... you're going to have to involve the credit provider in that discussion, because they may turn around and say, oh, I'm not going to accept that. There's going to have to be a space advocate for someone's going to have to adjudicate that, because maybe the consumer may say, let's just say the original debt was 50,000, they say, you know, I've got 40,000. Maybe the credit provider may say, listen, I just want to, let's just be done with this and move on. So, I mean, we just need to think about that buyout clause, and does that require adjudication in itself?
Yes, I'm actually just trying to get this
I can see it over there, but it doesn't refer to buying up.
While you were walking around.
No, the point is this is what's on the overhead supposed to be moving along. Where's the reference to buy up
then? There's no reference.
No, but the paragraph to which you were referring to, or is there something that's not related to the
Chairperson, on the clause C, above point 7, we were talking in there about including the clause that I proposed earlier today about buying yourself out or getting access to credit again. But I just want to keep talking about that. I don't believe that the criteria for getting yourself off the list of people who can't access credit anymore should have anything to do with the credit providers. I don't think it should. So if you buy yourself out, then I think if you, the people who decide you're allowed to buy yourself out or you can buy yourself should take the full amount of money that was you know, your debt relief, that number, and that should be paid back. And then it should just be paid to the person who wrote that money off or got rid of that, you know, who removed that. And I don't think we should have the credit provider involved in should I be allowed to buy myself out, because they might object and say, no, you can't, you know. I mean, I don't know. I'm just saying we should keep them out of that process.
Someone talk about, well, it depends how much, etc. And you said that earlier this morning. You know, you may think you can repay the lot, and yet you can't. You know, it's almost wishful thinking. So isn't it a matter for discussion between yourself and, the, you know, the tribunal? Or you think, no, you can take a decision.
That's true. I think I'm also speaking to what Honorable Williams is saying. There shouldn't be any communication between the client and the credit provider. This should exclusively be a discussion between the tribunal and the client. And if it is, you see there will be an amount, the last amount that the client, that the credit provider would say, for instance, $2,500 or X amount. And that should be the amount that this person, the client, pays off if they want to be acknowledged after
this. No, I do agree on that, but it seems as if not everyone agrees. That's what I'm saying at this point. To me, it sounds perfectly reasonable, but let's flag it because no one's in full agreement with it. But can we at least agree on the point that should this happen, the credit provider should not be involved? Now, I'm looking at yourself under all that person because you've objected to this. Because remember, it's been handed over already. It's at the tribunal now.
I'm just trying to look at the different permutations of how this thing works. I'm not sure that in a contractual obligation between a credit provider and consumer, unless it is extinguished and law provides for that, I just don't know, advocate, if and then someone then says, then hang on a moment, to get out of this, I want to buy it back. How do you buy back something that's been extinguished? Is that not a re-acknowledgement of a contractual obligation?
Honourable one,
Elsie. Chair, I'm also thinking, when we talk about the extinguishing of the debt, surely what the credit provider might do is blacklist this person. So the intention that we are having is to remove that black spot from the client. For instance, and then there needs to be some kind of provision made.
Yeah.
In terms of I don't know where we should fit it in, or is it even should it be given to the tribunal or something like that. But there should be that option for a person that the debt, even if the debt is extinguished, when you buy back, you will be able to access credit again.
I agree, absolutely.
What's worrying me on this one is we've got this process in hand. Starts off with a suspension, etc. Then it moves, and I sort of understood where the buyout began to be a possibility. Was you've had this for a year now, and you're going into perhaps the second year, and suddenly you get this good job, out the blue, top job here. And, well, I mean, of course you can afford this now. And what would have happened if you hadn't have got the job? You would have had to face the, I don't want to call it a sanction, but some clause which said, look, all right, now once this is paid off, not for 3 years or 5 years can you apply for credit. Am I understanding you correctly? And yet, you can have a credit now. So you're saying, okay, if we're at this point where I'm in the second year, or even at the end of this period, is there any way I can show you and prove to you that I've got this new job, you know, and I'm prepared to repay this $20,000. Is that going to be possible or not? Yes, Honourable Van Skalkveld.
But Chair, I thought that we've already dealt with that matter.
Okay.
With the issue of if your circumstances change at any moment before finalization of the extinguishing. So I think we are talking now about after the process of extinguishing.
But you still face the possibility of the 4 years, or I don't know what it was, 3 or 5 years, when you're not allowed to take a loan.
No.
But now you can take this loan. But, you know, you've paid off, you know, you can afford to pay it. That is something we haven't actually considered, fully, you know, considered it. And I wouldn't like us just to move ahead too rapidly on it, because it poses other problems with, well, are we actually going to extinguish this debt? Because there may be a problem which says once you've extinguished a debt, it's extinguished. Do you follow? Yes, Honourable William.
Chairperson, we must come up with a mechanism where a person who's has suddenly changed their, so they could have won the lotto, we don't know what's going to happen, their circumstances have changed, they've got resources now, but they want to borrow money to buy a yacht. So they have the resources to pay back that yacht, but because of this tiny bit of debt relief we gave them, they're not allowed to access any credit at all. So that a mechanism must be put in place for them to buy out of that that situation. If the complication comes that, well, the credit provider can now say, well, maybe that person can pay me back eventually, I'm not going to write their debt off or extinguish their debt, then perhaps they shouldn't pay that money to the service, to the credit provider. But there should be a way in which they can pay it to the, I don't know, the National Education Fund, I don't know, the SPCA, the, I don't know, you know, but they must be able to have an option to pay it back. Yeah, or some, yes.
I think I do understand what you're saying, and you also made a mini proposal there about saying you could pay it into X. You know, that, yeah. Now, Honourable McPherson?
Yeah, actually, I don't think we're too far from actually settling this matter. I think that if the Honourable William has had 50,000 Rand with interest extinguished, and he's been through the process and he's now not able to apply for credit for 5 years, and he's got himself a new job, and he's able to actually go back to that credit provider and say, here is your 50,000 Rand, the tribunal may then rescind that order, which then puts him back into the credit market. But I think what Advocate Santa Merva needs to work out is while you may not, you can't rescind extinguished debt, but you can rescind or suspend the order that he may not reapply for a loan for 5 years. And I think that's probably the legalese that we need to work out.
I think I would certainly support the idea, look, you can't rescind certain things, but you could say this clause which impedes you from taking a loan. Now, you know, that goes away, falls away, and there is, if you like, not a penalty, but some sort of amount of money, seen as you are in this very fortunate circumstance, of perhaps you pay X amount into some fund. Yeah. Yeah, something along those lines, so that you are well off now for whatever the reason, and you have that option. What does that sound too far-fetched for you, Advocate van der Merwe?
What I would suggest is that the committee gives me an opportunity just to go and study how rehabilitation works under sequestration.
Okay.
Because because what we are doing here is kind of an informal sequestration process.
Oh, I'm with you.
And that I do this because I'll maybe just have to ask, I'll see if I can find an attorney that will do me a favor and just explain to me what is paid back under rehabilitation, because I think it's a practical thing. I don't think it's actually in the law.
Yeah.
But that I can get my mind around that. And I think that is probably the best principle to apply here because it has a precedent in law. So the question about because even with sequestration, if the order was for 40 cents in the rand, the 60 cents in the rand was written off legally, not accountancy written off. It's extinguished. That creditor can never again try and get that 60 cents in the rand back. But when you want to do an early rehabilitation, there is a payment made.
Oh, right.
So it is exactly the same thing that we're struggling with here. So I'll just go and find out how rehabilitation works in practice. Mm-hmm. I know that it is possible, but I've never done an actual rehabilitation like that, just to see what it is, what are the requirements, etc. And probably not applied 100% because we are talking about a different income range here, but the principle to apply that. So I will go and look at that and apply that.
Look, we are making a very good progress. Let's proceed.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. The last subsection under that section 7 deals with the things that we are not happy with. If the information, if the tribunal receives information that the consumer was dishonest in the application, then it can be rescinded or amended, I suppose, depending on the nature of the dishonesty. The one thing that I need to add is that we've also agreed that that must be an offence.
Yes,
it will probably not be here in this section. I probably the Credit Act has a section that deals with offences. I'll probably just slot it in there.
Under the fraud or, you know.
In the application.
Yeah, but the fact that anywhere you're not allowed to make dishonest statements, you sign this and say this is a true reflection.
Yes.
And otherwise, it's, you know, isn't that a criminal offence whether or not you state so? Or do you think it is even more important that we do make it clear here?
Chair, initially my view was that it's an any-length fraud. It isn't any-length a crime. But it was one of the concerns that came up is how do we get people to know that there will be a problem if you lie on your application?
Okay.
So, you know, if we then make it clear that is an offence. I just wanted to see the offence section because I know that there are specific penalties attached to it.
Yeah.
So that might differ from fraud penalties. Mm-hmm. And then that is something else that the committee will just have to consider. I think it didn't sound a lot to me, to be very honest. I seem to recall something like 12 months jail, which I don't know if you've lied on this.
Probably just assault that someone's looking for
they
you.
Have a
so 12 months is a minor crime, it's district court, so I don't know. The committee might say district court penalties are sufficient for providing false information. Then also the tribunal may also rescind or vary, probably more rescind if the person fails to comply with conditions of the order or fails to comply with restrictions. That, however, I don't know if that should be an offence. Probably the fact that it can be rescinded the debt relief, because the rescission of the debt relief order will mean that interest starts running back from the application date.
Mm.
So that's quite a strict penalty that, that would be placed on that. And then, that is that. The next section deals with prescribed debt relief that the minister prescribed. The first subsection, I know that section 171 does provide for forms and things like that to be prescribed by the minister, but I have included it in here because I have a prescribing section. Like I say, if the instruction changes and we say we don't want the minister to prescribe because we feel Parliament must always give consent, whatever, then this will probably also come out. So subsection 1 just says the minister may prescribe forms, time periods, information required, procedures to ensure the want of debt relief measure is administered smoothly, including documents that would constitute proof of income or other information that might be required for the application. Then 2 simply gives the minister the power to prescribe debt relief. 3 is where we start with the criteria. So a debt relief measure must alleviate household debt, and then there are 3 main criteria. The one is the measure, what type of measure. The other one is who it may benefit. And the last one is the economic circumstances. And all 3 of these must be present unless the minister wants to come and ask permission from the House to go broader.
Yes. Under B, the benefit, we must add in there the 10,000 rand story. Is that not correct? The proposed 10,000 that's flagged. Is that, I'm just checking, because it's not there at the moment.
I'm sorry to interrupt, just to confirm that because we've changed the description of the applicant,
yes,
that would then have to feed through into this.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. I'm going to ask that we pass this aside because I think this is going to be a contentious issue.
Which one?
88E.
Uh-huh.
The whole section. Yeah, I think we need to go back to what the purpose of this is to identify and assist those people who need who need relief. I think by then giving the minister an opportunity for discretion. I mean, if we thought that fees must fall with that, wait until protests outside, 90 Plain Street that go debt must fall. Because you're going to have, people that believe that they must have their debt, extinguished.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's a belief that the minister has discretion to do so, there's going to be enormous pressure piled on him by interest groups to do exactly that. We need to keep this process, very, very rigid in the hands of someone who can actually adjudicate this on a case-by-case basis, and to a tribunal that will produce a fair income. Now, I'm not opposed to exemptions to this, and I think that exemptions can exist. Like addressing economic circumstances that constitute a significant shock or caused by a disaster.
Yeah.
But when we start saying persons who are subject to adverse conditions in a sector or region identified by a minister, I mean, does that mean that the people of KZN can start protesting for their debt to be extinguished as a region. I don't understand, you know, to what length that can go to. Or can the city of Cape Town go on strike until their debt is extinguished by proclamation of the minister? And so I really think that we need to take a long, hard look at this and think through the consequences of giving discretionary power to the minister, notwithstanding that there is a place for it, but I think that it needs to be exceptionally limited, exceptionally focused on the smallest group of people possible, and not allowing for broad, sweeping, application.
Right. I didn't hear what
you are saying, but I thought that on the one hand, especially when Ms. Gibson was saying the major go to must or can or etc., mm-hmm. that you're already telling the minister you must do this. He doesn't have a choice. The minister must prescribe forms. The thing is, time periods. Are you having a problem about those issues when it says already it has to be in accordance with section 171? You know, it has already ring-fenced the minister in to ensure that one sort of debt relief measure is administered smoothly. You're mainly, if you like, the minister in this sense is acting as almost just a clerk, taking this out, implementing that and giving you a period. So I didn't think that offered any form of discretion, but you then did refer to something else. What was it, the one you actually read up?
Chair, I think, yes. I mean, under benefits,
yes.
I mean the minister has the ability to actually completely bypass the bill or the act when it is enacted to declare debt under a credit agreement as extinguished. He has the power to replace the tribunal, and I'm not sure that that's wise, because if you have section B4. And I mean that is open to interpretation. What is considered an adverse condition? Is it too hot? It's too cold. An adverse condition is that there is a strike. The province is on a strike. Is that an adverse condition? And so I really think that we need to look at three. What prescriptions they may, or at least what measures the minister may prescribe, and then who benefits from those prescribed measures.
Yes.
Now,
you see,
The way I see it, you're not opposed to all of this, but you're opposed to when you see a classification like adverse. That in a way it's too subjective. What do you mean by adverse? What does the minister mean by adverse? So I don't hear you actually saying that you don't think things should be prescribed here, but rather the concern that you seem to be raising is the interpretation that would rest with the minister in what could be considered adverse. What does he think could be adverse? May not be what I think is adverse. I mean, it's that is a concern. That's what I'm hearing you say, rather than the points that the minister must prescribe this time period, etc. Do you not think that is it, or do you want to, Honourable Maxwell?
Yeah, Chair. I mean, I'm not sure it's something that we're going to come to an agreement on today.
No.
So. I mean, I know it's late in the day, and maybe we can save our energy for some other time. But I just think it's something that, you know, we as the legislature, you know, well, certainly from my side of the house in the legislature,
You know, we feel that the executive has too much power without consulting the legislature, without being directed by the legislative arm of government. And I'm concerned that these provisions in 88E, without more rigorous definition and application, are open to interpretation and are open to abuse. And that's something we don't want to see happen.
I think you've really captured it, Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, I think that Honourable McPherson is correct on this. I think we should absolutely define what the minister can and cannot do here. We should not leave it to the discretion because, you know, all sorts of things can happen. You know, we're not writing this legislation necessarily for this Minister of Trade and Industry. It could be somebody in 20 years' time who says, I'm going to, yes, exactly.
Yeah.
It could be Honourable McPherson, and we're not going to, you know, yeah.
Then I'll say, but you let me.
But the other issue is, you know, a tighter definition of, for example, adverse. You know, what this is what we mean, right? So I think you've got the general drift there, Advocate van der Merwe, as to where we're going. Yes, do go ahead.
Thank you. I just want to make something clear. It is not an option that's being given in respect of B or C.
Mm-hmm.
From discussions, I think that maybe it is not that clear, and I must maybe change the way that I've drafted it, because the minister may only prescribe measures if there is either a significant exogenous shock that caused widespread job losses,
yes,
or if there was a natural disaster, or if there was no efficient or effective method to alleviate household debt. This last one might be the broad one that we need to link directly with the issue of the liquidation process, the informal liquidation process. I must maybe take those two out, put them separately,
yes,
because the beneficiaries speaks to the economic circumstances. So I must maybe start with saying that the minister may prescribe measures under the following circumstances.
Yes.
Under those circumstances, these are the only people who may benefit. And the type of measures that he may prescribe must be. So maybe separate it, because I think the A, B, and C might be confusing a little bit, because in my mind it's quite clear because I understand what I've drafted. But, if it is confusing, it means that the man on the street is also going to be confused. And that probably includes the minister. So we don't want to, this is your bill. You can't be the man on the street with this. But, I'll do that.
A man in the A4 is hardly a man of the
A4. It's probably not necessarily going to resolve all the issues that have been discussed, but I think if we clear it up that way, it already makes it an easier product to talk to.
Now, I think that we can move on at this point. Don't you think so, Member?
Yeah.
Right. And, I mean, look, it's nearly four, so let's try and see if we can get through to that particular point, which is the last page.
Subsection 4 deals with the process that the minister must comply with, and in fact, yes, that is the last of the needs of the bill.
Yeah.
The process is that the minister must consult the National Assembly, minister responsible for finance, justice, NCR, tribunal, credit industry.
Yeah.
B says, then the minister must publish a notice in the Gazette that indicates the type of debt relief measure, group of consumers that will qualify, type and value of debt, process for application. So the concern that Ms. McPherson had about the extinguishing, that the minister can extinguish debt, it is just that the measure can extinguish, he needs to indicate what will be the application in order to get it extinguished. And the consequences of the measure, and must provide parties at least 30 days within which to comment thereon.
Yeah.
Paragraph C then says he must consider the comments, and I've made a note here that he must also consider the comments in the consultations with the Assembly, with Minister of Finance, Minister of Justice, MTR, Tribunal, Credit, and so that we don't exclude those comments.
Yeah.
So Minister must then discuss in a report the comments from all of those parties, any comments resulting from the Gazette publication, and table in the National Assembly this report on these comments received and the final debt relief measure that he in fact intends to introduce. The problem with just tabling in the Assembly, it's not a problem, but just to explain the consequence, it does not mean that the National Assembly will have to approve it. But the fact of tabling does mean that it is made public. It will be referred to a portfolio committee. I can't see it being referred to any other portfolio committee but the Committee on Trade, who will then be able to discuss it and bring it out into the public if there are concerns about persons' comments being ignored or disregarded. Those things can then be addressed in public. So Parliament can use its public power to hold the minister accountable.
Yeah, agreed.
But it will not be a consent issue.
Thank you, Chair. Advocates seem to be confused then, because in 4A1, it says that it will be consulted, but then it must obtain the permission of the National Assembly to proceed.
It is where the debt relief measure proposed falls outside of the criteria. So if it does not comply with A, B, or C. So if he doesn't want to do something that caps interest or suspends or declares debts as extinguished, he wants to do something different. Or he wants to benefit people who earn between 10,000 and 100,000. Or he wants to prescribe debts for because anyone who drives a BMW needs to have that relief. That kind of I'm sorry for that example. I could not think of anything very arbitrary, in other words, would have to get
the
permission.
Point of when you mentioned the amount, we're looking at 10,000 now. Perhaps in 10 years, 10,000 would be the equivalent to 5,000 today, you know, or even less, you see. I think that was a very good example, that particular one.
Chair?
But let's allow you to speak, Honourable McPherson.
Because, I mean, in my mind, what I'd like to see is, I would like to see 4A that almost reversed. I would like to see the minister consult the Minister of Finance, Justice, the NCR and Tribunal and Credit Industry, and then once he or she has done so, then come to Parliament with those views and then get the permission of the National Assembly to proceed. But right now it's the other way around. So he or she may go first to the National Assembly, then to the Minister of Finance, then to the Justice and the Credit Industry, where I think it would be important for Parliament to first understand what the views of those role players are, then the Minister comes to Parliament and expresses those. The problem that I have with C is that I think in instances that have the ability to affect the credit market, I think that Parliament should be the final arbiter of it. I think that permission or approval should be given by Parliament in section.
No, but you said for
was the action that the minister seeks to take.
Yeah, but specific about the area you said.
Well, whatever area that he looks to prescribe.
No, because I was concerned when you said finance, when I would have thought that the place the minister should go would have been finance then,
so
rather
So I just want to explain how I think it should work.
Right.
I think that if the minister wants to prescribe a measure, he should do so by first consulting the Minister of Finance, Minister of Justice, the NCR Tribunal, the credit industry, and then come to the National Assembly with all of that information. Obtain permission from the National Assembly to proceed. And then to, by way of government gazette, to gazette it, and then once he's got those objections, etc., come back to the National Assembly with a consolidated view, and for the National Assembly to then say that debt may be done, not by just simply tabling it, because a committee may have a differing view by that time, but it's already been enacted. And so I think that Parliament, I think that the House needs to be the final body that then says yay or nay.
Look, let's hear from Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, as far as I can see, four, it says exactly what Honourable McPherson has just said. It says, one, go to the National Assembly, two, the Minister, etc., and at the end, C, it says, after consideration of the comments contemplated in paragraph B, table in the National Assembly a report. So exactly what Honourable McPherson said is exactly the order that it's written in the bill.
Well, read the bill.
Look, no. Look, I think let's listen to everyone. Honourable Tierker.
I want to understand what I was saying. It must, the minister must, or it should be in consultation.
No, not in. We've already said that. It's not in consultation. Must consult. In consultation would mean that if one of them disagrees with the minister, you can't move. But consultation means you have consulted your colleagues, who often will give you some very valuable and constructive input, you see. Like the Minister of Finance may well say that, well, we can't afford that one. And remember, anything that's done in the House would first have had to have gone to Cabinet. And whether we accept it or not, Cabinet is a collegiate structure. You know, you can't just ignore Cabinet when you bring things to Parliament. So you would have had that process as well. So I think your fears may be misplaced, but it certainly doesn't mean that we shouldn't flag it so that you have a better chance of appreciating what it is that your colleagues are saying, Honourable McPherson. All right. And then we move on. Yes, we're really getting there. Thank you.
Chair, that is kind of the last of the big sections. The rest becomes consequential amendments. So I don't know if we should... If we go on to consequential amendments, we should probably start from the beginning of the book.
Yeah. Well, look, there's one thing that, as we've moved through this and go through it, you've got the short title and commencement. The one is called, this act is called the National Credit Amendment Act 2017. But it's on the last page 29. But we know what we've been referring to it so often is the debt relief, but it would be referred to as that, as I understand it, advocate, but that the explanation would be to address this. This is the National Credit Amendment Act to address 1, 2, 3. Is that not how it works, Mr. Niasi Tenzi? I think you've seen enough bills, advocate.
The debt relief bill would be like the secrecy bill. It would not be it would just be a nickname that we refer to. Because it amends the National Credit Act, it will have to be an amendment act. But the 2017 will quite likely change. I don't think we are going to get it through this year still. It's probably going to change in 2018. But that in any event, we will get that number from the bill's office once the bill has been passed by both houses.
You know, members, when I look at where we've gone and, you know, process after the last previous term of Parliament before, a lot of things have happened. I remember in so many ways. I think, Honourable MacPherson, you were a member of the 4th Parliament from the beginning, weren't you? And that the Honourable Oriani Ambrosini actually came in with an amendment having actually gone to the Constitutional Court and was successful, and then you got a new process of a private member's bill. Could not be held up, you know, Parliament looking at it. And you went through, and at the time that it went through, we were the first committee to be involved in processing that bill. And we really gave it a lot of highlight, as some of you will remember, because it underpinned the power of Parliament. It also underpinned the authority and power of the individual MPs. And by the same token, as we've heard from the advocate, there have been many committee bills, you know, amendments, but they have been something like about 10 pages or 5 pages, very tiny things. This one will be effectively so far the largest, significantly, but we are only dealing with one issue, notwithstanding that. And I think that it will lay a platform, provide a basis for other amendments in the Credit Act to move on. And one of you said today, I don't know if it was yourself, Honourable MacPherson, that the National Credit Act was probably one of the most important pieces of legislation this Parliament ever passed. And it certainly saved this country from just collapsing in the same manner that many emerging economies and developed economies went. And that is what has saved us. But it'll be up to the Minister, I believe, to, once we've done this, there are many flaws within that piece of legislation that need to be dealt with, and that would be done so. But I do want to thank you. It's been a very long day, and you've all been here dedicated. Thank you. And I want to request, members, that you do try and read all of the inputs that were made, including the papers that have been contributed here. Yes, I think I should run a little spot test. But Mr. Hermans would like to speak to you on the program changes. The days remain the same, but just have a look and listen.
Now we are using this one. This is a fourth please, so that you prepare for Tuesday. Based on the discussion, the program for next Tuesday, we've invited National Treasury and SARS to address some of the concerns raised today. NCT and NCR and DTI will also make a presentation on the issues that have been identified. We will receive a status report on the copyright bill. We will not discuss the copyright bill, but we will just give a status of where it is, and Edmondson and Mary will speak to that. Mm-hmm. We also will have an engagement with the French ambassador on the issue that the chair has raised.
Yeah, you know, employment is very interesting. Short engagement on the whole French bill.
On Wednesday, we will continue with deliberations on debt. Then on Thursday afternoon, we will engage at 2:30, engage with the African Farmers Development Association. It's an issue that the chair raised yesterday. Mm-hmm. And then on Friday, we will have the first look at the draft report.
But there will also be something else on Thursday, but it is difficult to give Mr. Hermans everything.
Yeah.
On Wednesday at the Manco, we'll be dealing with certain things, and one of them is going to be this whole localization and the terms of reference. On Thursday, we have met Nimrod Zuck, all of us, and you know, he worked, he assisted us with the tips and briefed us on localization, etc. We would like him, at the Manco, certainly, to have made this input, but it may be valuable if we can get someone like that to make some input, and the National Development and Planning and Monitoring Ministry has indicated that they are working with DTI on this very issue, you know, some of the challenges. And I thought that it could be very constructive for us to listen to them for half an hour and then engage them on the matter.
so that we are more effectively prepared for this inquiry, which I can assure you is a major inquiry, and we hope will achieve even more than what the steel produced, you know, the objective, because it directly addresses the issue of employment, of the black industrialization. It directly addresses growing the economy. So these are what trade and industry is involved in. So, Mr. Hermans, just carry on then. The Thursday should continue from 2 until 6 or something.
Well,
yeah.
And then on Friday, I think you'll start to look at the first draft. Then on Tuesday, the 17th, we'll continue with the committee board on debt relief, and we'll invite the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, as well as Department of Labour, to address the issues that come. DTI, NCR will be part, and NCT will be part of that conversation. And then the committee, and then on Wednesday, the committee will probably deliberate on that particular thing that emanates from that discussion. And then we will probably, on Thursday, depending on the approval of the House of Sitting, the committee will probably start looking at the copyright. Then we'll move into copyright.
Yeah.
But we'll get a briefing on the copyright, I'm just coming, on the 17th also. Just a briefing on the bill that has been worked on thus far from the task team on the 17th.
Now look, the days haven't changed. Except for one thing, you know, tomorrow we're not meeting, but we are meeting next Friday. So that replaces tomorrow, as it were. So that you should be aware. Honourable Van Schalkwyk?
Thank you, Chair. Can we just get an electronic version?
Oh, yes. No, it's just been done here as we're working on, etc. All right. No, and I think so that
every member is clear. Look, the media has approached me just to get clarity on exactly what this inquiry involves. There are many different forms of an inquiry, but our concern really, or our approach, is to first work on the persuasion, and the staff will ring up the relevant people and say, look, we've scheduled it for this and we hope you can come there or the afternoon or the next day. In other words, we mutually agree at the timing per se. But if members, and we've had such an entity, I think Honourable Williams, you and the Honourable McPherson remember very well the National Consumer Commissioner's approach before the current one. I mean, at the morning before, after the third time of even saying, you give us the time, you do it, gives us the time, and then phones us after we've been waiting half an hour, hasn't even boarded the plane, I forgot I've got a prior engagement. Clearly, that is not acceptable. Do you hear what we are saying? Now, we didn't even summons her, we warned her we would summons. So the approach is work with people first. It's only if you find someone as recalcitrant that you bring out the real armory, if I may put it that way. Don't you agree? Fine. Thank you. So that is where we are. You don't have to come here in your armor, you know, when we start the inquiry. Okay. Thank you very much to all of you. And get back to your constituencies, wherever it is you're going, safely. Did you want to? I wanted to adjourn.
Yes.
So we are adjourned. Until 9 o'clock on Tuesday. V227. TV, that's a big
one.